8 years ago, I started doing independent broadcasting because we were dealing with the Red Hill Creek situation. People have been protesting the removal of that large urban forest for 50 years. When Larry Deanney was finally elected mayor, things started to change. His agenda was with the agenda of the developers. Remove the trees and allow more urban sprawl on the top of the escarpment in Stony Creek.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
This was the beginning for me. The stories you're about to hear are from some of the protesters, some of the educators, and the First Nations people, all working together to try and wake up society to the fact that cutting down trees is not the good thing to do.
My name is Louisa Kratka. It's good to be back in Hamilton. I grew up in Hamilton. I've been in Nova Scotia for the summer. Allow me to just explain my story a little bit. I'll try to be brief. I feel that I'm living proof that we need the trees. I have environmental illness, and I've had a hell of a year living. Throughout my life, I've been exposed to a lot of chemicals. I went to art school. I was exposed to lacquer thinners, Varsol solvents, and things like that. And when I finished in 99, I returned to the area here, and I lived in the East End for a little while. What environmental illness is pretty much is severe like sensitivities, allergies to car exhaust, molds. It's also called multiple chemical sensitivity. I had a hard time walking down the streets. I often wore this scarf and had to cover my face. I had to leave. I decided to go to Nova Scotia to be near the ocean, the clean air, and I have healed a little bit. If it weren't for the trees, I don't know what I would have done.
I just wanted to mention that you ought to go to the city website and take a look at a position they've posted there. It's for the Red Hill Valley Project Environmental Coordinator. And I'd just like to read two very brief excerpts. It says here that they're going to use best practices approach, whatever that means, I have to do some research, to develop and deliver quality environmental advice, information, services in a timely and cost-effective manner. Well, you want to know what this position pays? About $60,000 to $70,000 a year on top of the billion, the millions they've already spent. And the other thing I just want to say is that, and I work for the cities, they're talking about cost effectiveness and they're talking about doing this in an environmentally friendly way, and that's not possible. So write a letter to your editor, write an editorial, get out there and tell them, go under careers on the city website and tell them that they're full of you know what.
My name is Anne-Marie Pavlov. I'd like to thank everyone who has been at the Valley every day this summer. There was one day when I went down this summer with my sister and we were sitting and we were talking to one of the native leaders and we're just shaking our heads like we felt so powerless. And she says, we've been doing this for 500 years. And then I thought, even if every goon you don't want to see in City Hall gets elected, imagine a council of all the goons. It doesn't matter. The struggle still doesn't stop. It doesn't. It goes on regardless of who's in there.
The words of Louisa May Alcott, do not doubt that a small group of concerned citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
Those were voices recorded at the Tivoli, which has since fallen to the ground. But people gathered at the Tivoli the fall after the summer of big fighting and big protest. There was entertainment there, too. This is a section from one of those entertainers.
In the morning mist, shot through with the blue of the heavens, a youth was making his way toward the beckoning mountains. His heart thrilled to the rhythmical beat of all the world. Without a care or worry, he went on for hours over the level country, when on reaching the edge of a forest, a voice rang out, sounding at once near at hand, far off, and very mysterious.
Go not through this forest, youth, unless you wish to commit murder.
The youth stood still in astonishment, looked in every direction, and seeing nowhere any sign of a living being, concluded that it was a spirit that had addressed him. But his innate courage would not permit him to heed the strange call, and reducing his gait only a little, he proceeded on his way without misgiving, his senses keenly alert in order that he might be prepared for a meeting with the unknown enemy that had warned him. But he met no one. Under the last wide boughs, he sank down for a short rest, allowing his eyes to wander out across a wide meadow toward the mountains, from among which one peak rose aloft, naked and sharply outlined. This was his ultimate goal. But scarcely had he arisen when for the second time the mysterious voice was heard.
Go not through this meadow, youth, unless you wish to bring ruin to your homeland.
The damp mist of evening descended upon the plain as he at last stood facing the rocky wall below his goal. Hardly had he set foot upon the bare surface of the stone when the voice rang out again.
No farther, youth, or else you will suffer death.
The youth laughed loudly and without haste or hesitation went on his way. And the less clear the ascending path became, the more did his chest expand. And finally, on the bravely conquered peak, his head was illumined by the last light of day. Here I am, he called out in a tone of triumph. If this was a test, oh good or evil spirit, then I have won. No murder weighs on my conscience. Unharmed slumbers my homeland below, and I still live. Whoever you are, I am stronger than you, for I did not believe you, and I did right. Whereupon came a great sound as of thunder from the mountainsides, and at the same time exceedingly close at hand.
Youth, you are mistaken.
And the overpowering weight of the words felled the wanderer. He stretched himself on the edge of the rock as though he intended to rest there, and with an ironical curl of the lips, he said to himself, so it appears that I have committed murder without knowing it.
Your careless foot has crushed a worm.
And the youth answered with indifference, I see, neither a good nor evil spirit spoke to me, but a spirit with a sense of humor. I was not aware that such hovered about among us mortals. And again the voice resounded in the fading twilight of the heights.
Are you no longer the same youth whose heart only this morning thrilled to the rhythmical beat of all the world? Is your soul so dead that you are untouched by the happiness and sorrow of even a worm?
Is that your meaning? Replied the youth, wrinkling his forehead. In that event, I am 100, 1,000 times guilty, like other mortals, whose careless steps have innocently destroyed tiny creatures without number.
Against this particular thing you were warned. Do you know what purpose this worm was destined in the internal scheme of things?
With sunken head, the youth made answer. Since I neither knew or could know that, you must humbly confess that in my wandering through the forest, I have committed precisely the one of many possible murders that it was your will to prevent. But how have I contrived my way over the fields to bring ruin to my homeland? I am really most curious to learn.
Youth, do you see the bright-colored butterfly that fluttered once to the right of you?
Many butterflies did I see, as well as the one you speak of.
Many butterflies. Many did the breath from your lips drive from their way, but the one I speak of was driven off to the east, winging its way far and wide until it flew over the golden fence that encloses the royal park. From that butterfly will be born the caterpillar, which next year, one hot summer afternoon, will crawl over the white neck of the young queen, awakening her so suddenly from her sleep that her heart will stand still in her breast and the fruit of her womb will languish and die. Thus the king's brother will inherit the kingdom instead of the rightful heir, whom you will have cheated of his life. Vicious, malicious, and cruel, he will so rule as to bring people to despair, madness, and finally, in a frantic effort to save himself, he will plunge his country into a terrible war and thus bring you and your homeland to ruin. And on no one but you rests the blame for all of this. You whose breath drove the colored butterfly eastwards across the meadow until it flew over the golden fence of the king's park.
The youth shrugged his shoulders. Oh, how invisible spirit can I deny that all this that you prophesy will come to pass? Since on earth one thing always follows from another, and often the most trivial events are caused by the most trivial things, and the most trivial events by the most terrible things. And why should I believe this particular prophecy, since the other threatening me with death should I mount these steps has not come to pass?
He who mounts those steps must turn back and descend them if he wishes to mix with mankind again. Hast thou pondered that?
O invisible spirit who has three times warned me, and whom I have three times refused to believe, O spirit to whom I now bow down as to one stronger than I, tell me, who are you?
No mortal has yet known me. Many names have I. The superstitious call me destiny, fools call me luck, and the pious call me God. To those who deem themselves wise, I am that power which was in the beginning and continues without end through all eternity.
Then I curse you in this my last moment, shouted the youth, with the bitterness of death in his heart. If thou art indeed the power that was in the beginning and continues without end through all eternity, then it was fated that all should happen as it did, that I should go through the forest and commit murder, that I should cross the meadow and bring ruin upon my homeland, that I should climb this rock and find here death. All this despite your warning. But why was I condemned to hear you speak to me three times, if your warning was not to help me? And why, O irony of ironies, must I in this last moment whimper my feeble question to you? An answer was made to the youth, stern and terrible, in a burst of mysterious laughter that echoed to the utmost confines of the invisible heavens. As he tried to catch the words, the earth moved and sank from under his feet. He fell deeper than a million bottomless pits amid all the lurking nights of time that have been and will be. From the beginning to the end of all things.
Dr. George Sorger from McMaster University gives us a background from an environmental point of view.
I'm going to be speaking to you about Red Hill Creek, but I think that we have to look at Red Hill Creek as something bigger than just the creek. Red Hill Creek actually supports the life of a forest, the biggest urban forest in southern Ontario. It is also, because of the forest and the creek, it is a bioreserve. With a number of endangered species, the most famous of which is the flying squirrel. But there's an uncatalogued number of insects. Nobody has ever gone to see what they are. There are lots of medicinal plants. There's a huge collection of birds, fish, and among the animals, there are mammals like deer, fox, and birds. Tremendous number of birds. In fact, it is on the migratory route of birds. So what I'm going to do then is I'd like to take you on a little journey down Red Hill Creek, tell you about some of the problems that we have encountered there, and I of course have to say who we is, and how the city is dealing with these problems, and finally how a large group of citizens, another us, is dealing with what the city is doing about the Red Hill Creek. So, first, who are we? We are an organization called Watershed Action Towards Environmental Responsibility, and what we do is we try to empower citizens here in Hamilton by teaching at McMaster, this is all volunteer, teaching high school students how to monitor pollution. specifically bacteria associated with pollution, E. coli to measure them, phosphate, ammonium, dissolved oxygen, and toxicity. And these are all measured properly, scientifically. In fact, we have published those results in international journals of science. So the measurements have to be accurate. This we do for a period of 5 weeks teaching. The students then respond to a community concern about a place. And they go and they monitor this place for 3 weeks, after which time they report their findings back to the community for the community to do what they see fit with this information, which could be suing the city. It has been done at least once successfully. So let me tell you then what we have found in Red Hill Creek as a result of community concerns along the creek. Red Hill Creek starts by coming out of a large sewer. Now, this is a creek that has been here for forever. It has archaeological sites in it. In fact, there is a village there that is being excavated now that is 11,000 years old. That is more than twice as old as the pyramids of Egypt. So this has been a settlement for a long, long time. It has fed humanity, and yet it is now buried under the city and comes out of a sewer, which is the way that we have been treating these creeks. Once it comes out of that sewer, it is extremely dirty. But amazingly, the creek, as it comes out of that, goes through rocky terrain and begins cleaning itself. So as you monitor it, there are fewer and fewer coliforms, that's bacteria and E. coli. But very soon after it comes out of there, it goes past the Ottawa Street landfill. And that is a bubble of toxic leachate. And we have looked at that, and in the past, we found that the leachate was coming out of the dump into the creek directly from several sites. There was a retaining wall, so-called, that had been built many years before, and the city had obviously neglected that so that the leachate was coming into the creek. This is completely illegal, and the city was doing nothing about it until, with our reports, the press, the Canadian press, took it up and embarrassed the city into doing some minimal remediation. Our friend Eusebio talked about vende patrias. These are people who sell out the country. We have vende pueblos around here. That is city fathers that sell out the people. So they have allowed this toxic leachate to come into the creek. At the present time, despite what we said, you know, this is a bubble sitting here. Right next to it is a big highway. It's the link. And we have warned the city on a number of occasions that all those trucks shaking that bubble could create a real problem. But they don't listen to scientists. They don't listen to economists. They don't listen to the people. They only listen to their own interests. And their own interest was that link, Lincoln-Alexander Highway. When the creek gets past the Ottawa Street landfill, it goes through an area of cattails that cleans the river a lot. And soon after that, it goes over Mount Albion Falls, which is a spectacularly beautiful place. It's a bowl with a beautiful waterfall, and at the bottom it's very rocky. And as the creek goes through this rocky area with very, very tall trees, it becomes clean again. And soon it will meet a little creek coming from another falls called Buttermilk Falls. And Buttermilk Falls comes from another canyon that's also very beautiful, and it originates also in a sewer. And when it comes out of that sewer, it is very filthy. And as soon as it comes out of the sewer, it's met by another sewer that makes it even more filthy, and a third sewer that makes it incredibly filthy. And then it goes over Buttermilk Falls, and as it goes through rocky terrain, it cleans itself. This is amazing how rivers and creeks can clean themselves despite all of what human beings have been doing to it. When you get down further, okay, we come across another creek that meets Red Hill Creek, and that is called Davis Creek. Davis Creek comes from another set of falls, very beautiful falls. And there is a sewer that empties right into the falls, and it is a filthy sewer. Okay. And right next to that, there's an escarpment, and from the escarpment, there are seeps of leachate. Well, I'm not supposed to say it's leachate because I don't know that it's leachate, but it happens to be very close to a dump. Okay? And it contains some of the things that dumps contain. And these leachates, or whatever seeps, tend to be toxic sometimes, so they kill the plant life underneath them. That flows into Davis Creek. Davis Creek then goes past a large building before getting into Red Hill Creek, where there are two very large sewers, and each of those dumps an awful lot of stuff in there. Now, when I say sewers, these are storm sewers. They're not supposed to be filthy. They're only supposed to have water coming out of them when it rains. But these places have water coming out all the time. And all the time, they have fecal contamination in them. So there's more to this than a storm sewer. I'm not going to tell you all of the various insults that Red Hill Creek gets, but we will come to one place that is important historically. And that is that citizens pointed out there was a gray plume coming into, near Queenston Road, gray plume coming into Red Hill Creek there. And the city was saying, no, that's nothing. That is just groundwater. Well, groundwater is not gray. So citizens asked us to look at that gray plume, and sure enough, it was pure sewage. And the citizens took the city to court, sued them, and the city then blamed a scapegoat, a poor fellow in the sewage treatment plant, who then had to accept the blame for what the city was doing. But they were forced to fix the problem, which is that they had built something and broken a sewer, which was then emptying into the creek. As we go further down, we finally come to the sewage treatment plant. And it's too bad that Gus Oliveira is not here, so I'm going to say some of the things that I believe he would have said. When we get to the sewage treatment plant, it empties its effluent into Red Hill Creek. And Red Hill Creek then empties into the bay, which then empties into Lake Ontario in the western end, which is where we take our drinking water from. Okay? It's in the same general area. So what I'm saying about Red Hill Creek and what I'm going to say about the sewage treatment plant is not unrelated to what we're going to drink and are drinking. The sewage treatment plant was privatized in 1995. And the contract was given to a set of entrepreneurs from the city who was supposed to conquer the world with their technology. But their technology really was mainly entrepreneurial technology. It had very little to do with treatment of water. Very shortly after the place was privatized, they did the same thing that most people do when they privatize places. They let go half the workers. And the workers that they let go were the most expensive workers, the most experienced workers. And it is probably no coincidence that shortly after that, there was a huge accident in which the basement of people in the East End were full of fecal contamination bubbling through their basements, and billions of liters of contaminated sewage went right into the creek and into the bay. It was the company, of course, blamed the technology and the pipes and the rest of it, but I think it probably has something to do with the fact that they let go their best people. The performance of the sewage treatment plant, there are three in the area, is the very worst of all three. The solids coming through are 10 times more concentrated in the effluent of the Woodward Avenue sewage treatment plant than they are from either of the two other sewage treatment plants, which are not more expensive. The phosphate levels are twice as high. The ammonium levels are 5 to 10 times as high. And half of the ammonium in the bay here in Hamilton comes out of the sewage treatment plant. And that, of course, goes into Lake Ontario. And this is the performance of the private enterprise. That private enterprise was passed without tender, without competition, which is supposed to be what makes private efficient, was passed on to Azurix, which is part of the Enron empire. When they got fed up with doing it, that was the sewage treatment plant performance didn't improve. They sold it to American Water Works, and you've heard about them too. The company keeps saying, when we go and measure very high levels of total coliforms, very low levels of dissolved oxygen, very high levels of ammonium in the effluent, they keep saying, well, we're improving and we're meeting our standards, because the standards, their certificate of approval, is essentially one that gives them the right to do almost anything. The certificate of approval is a relative one. They have to remove a certain percentage of the bacteria, not reach a certain level of quality. So that, and if things are exceeded, if they feel that there's too much stuff coming through them, they can just bypass, which they completely do, bypass the sewage straight out into Red Hill Creek, which they do very frequently. So this is the private performance. And what they're proud of is that they've saved money. They have saved money by firing the workers, essentially. And as I said, they keep saying that they're putting in money to this. And there was a question earlier about, you know, they're going to improve this. But they keep saying they're going to improve this, improve this, improve this. But when we measure things, they haven't. It's always the same. They haven't improved it. If anything, in the last year, it's been marginally improved in ammonium, but that's very, very little. So we come then to the consequences of this sewage treatment plant is Windermere Basin. And Windermere Basin is just downstream from the sewage treatment plant. It is a total cesspool. It is a basin which is, the bottom of which is covered with fecal bacteria. Every now and then you see lots of dead fish on there, okay? And we have been reporting this now for years to the city. And what the city has been saying is, well, you know, your methods are questionable. Not, we're going to do something about this. And our methods, as I said, were published in one of the top internal journals in science. But then our counselors don't have scientific degrees, yet they think they know more about science than professional scientists. Well, the city is very proud of something that they have been bringing people to today, which is the Green Hill tank. They have a huge, big tank that is going to catch some of the pollutions, and they're showing this off to the people. See, we are doing things about this. Well, we reported that there was an old Green Hill tank that was leaking practically raw sewage into Red Hill Creek, but it was a very small trickle. And really, the way to correct that was not to build a new tank. It was to correct the problem in the old tank. It would have been much, much cheaper. So why are they building a new tank? Or why have they built a new tank? I think it has something to do with construction companies that build tanks and that build expressways, okay? That they're the friends of our friends in City Hall. And therefore, when you have to fix a small problem, but that doesn't give a big contract to your friends, then you don't do that. Instead, you give a big contract to your friends. So what is the solution then to all of this problem as far as the city is concerned? They're going to build an expressway through the valley. And that expressway is going to pave a quarter of that valley. They're going to cut down 40,000 trees, more than that. They're going to pave over archaeological sites. They're going to destroy all of the wildlife there, and therefore all of the habitat that is associated with it. And they say, look, with the highway, we're going to fix all of those problems that you've been telling us about, because that's part of the highway program. There was no need to have a highway program to address the problems of those sewers. You address the problems of the sewers without making the highway, but they didn't do that. So now we have a program for this expressway, which is going to kill the valley. And what has happened actually is interesting. Tony Clark was speaking about resistance. What happened is many people in the city found this intolerable. And many of us went up there and we stood in front of the trucks that were going to start construction and stopped them. We stopped them the first day. They came back with the police and everything. And we stopped them a second day. And then they came back again. And we stopped them a third day, and then they decided that until the police removed us, they wouldn't come back. So we saw that as a tremendous triumph, you know. But unfortunately, the city declared that as illegal. So we asked ourselves, well, what does this illegal stuff mean? You know, illegal. Does legal have anything to do with justice? Or is this illegal just a way of implementing the will of the powerful in this case is? And that's exactly what this is. They've actually invented laws to convert the area that we were occupying and preventing them from coming in, okay, to convert that from a park into their property so that they could kick us off there. So they slapped an injunction on us, and six of us went forward and tried to defend in front of the court. The six presented all of the things that the city has been doing wrong. It's been neglectful of Red Hill Creek. It has broken the laws, that is, the laws of protecting the creek. They were going to go in there and cut down trees with migratory birds, which is against the Migratory Birds Act. They were going to go and pave that valley against the will of the native peoples without consulting them. All of these things were pointed out in the court, but the court ruled against us because it's their property, and their property to do whatever they like with it. So what has happened? We have been kicked off, but native peoples have taken over, and they're still there. And I hope they continue to be there. And they're actually struggling with some of their own authorities. So that's very interesting. It's a struggle of people against bad authorities. And that's, I think, the only way that we can stop these people, because the authorities and their laws are all set against what we know is right and just. And we have to protect what's right and just, regardless of what the authorities and even their instruments tell us what has to be done. And the irony of this is they call this progress.
Since then, our pollution rate has climbed by the hundreds. Stony Creek area has faced at least two major flooding issues, and they will continue to get flooding issues again. This is an example from the city of Hamilton of what not to do. 8 years ago, we were fighting in Hamilton over the Red Hill Creek. It is an urban forest, or it was an urban forest, which is a very rare thing to find in a major city. But Hamilton, Ontario, is an example of what happens all over the world. We had an urban forest. We were lucky. It helped to control rainwater runoff. It helped cool the city. It helped breathe the carbon dioxide out of the air. But we didn't know how much it helped until it was gone. 8 years ago, I started recording some of the comments, some of the activists, because I wondered too. I thought, why are so many people fighting for so long over the 7 kilometers of urban forest? I walked through it. It was wonderful. I enjoyed it. I saw mink. I saw flying squirrels. I saw creatures I have never seen in the Hamilton area before. I was actually surprised that one of the more polluted sides of Hamilton had all this greenery and running fresh water. Yes, I think it was safe enough to drink. After 50 years of fighting, tensions became even more intense. There are different aspects to look at this time. There were First Nations people claiming the land. There were young activists claiming the future is theirs. And there were activists that have been fighting for this freeway not to go through for as long as they can remember. So I started being an independent broadcast reporter. I went out into the woods and followed the story all the way along. Wherever there was a rally, wherever there was a fight, wherever there was a protest, I tried to be there to record what it was like. Another activist, artist, actually made a wonderful film about what happened during the final days of the Red Hill Valley. That film is called Grass Through Concrete. Grass Through Concrete was produced and directed by Maya Yatsuba. She was recording the video and doing interviews one way, and I was recording the audio and doing radio broadcasts from my end. There were all kinds of protesters. Some of them were in their 80s and they tied themselves to trees. Let's go to an interview we did with some of the protesters that were actually in the woods at the time. This was from a show done in 2003.
Barb, let's go to you. And this woman's not shy about mentioning her age, so we're going to tell everybody how old she is. She's 72 years old. She went out and chained herself for over 4 hours to a tree in the damp and the wet and the cold. And you want to tell us what motivated you to do that, Barb?
I'll be glad to. For me, it was a personal and a community issue affecting both health and recreation. I felt that I was being denied my democratic right to use the public park as one of two groups warned against using the park once the construction was complete, the other group being children. Because obviously the toxic emissions would affect the health of both children and seniors. Replacing 40,000 trees with 4,000 diesel trucks daily was going to affect not just my health, but the health of the community. And so this, to me, was an issue of great importance. And for that reason, I was quite willing to chain myself to a tree and spend four uncomfortable hours in the damp and cold to get that message to our city councilors.
Were you worried at all about what would happen if you got arrested?
Well, I tried not to think about that. I felt that I was exercising my democratic right to protest against the destruction of the valley, not just on my own behalf, but on behalf of my family, and like to think that I was doing it on behalf of friends and the community at large. So I didn't really think about getting arrested. I thought if it happens, then we'll deal with it.
Okay, and you've lived up there for how many years? You live right up by the taro dump, isn't it?
Yes, we live in Upper Stony Creek and have done for the last 25 years. And prior to that, we lived on Pritchard Road, which is very close to the Red Hill Valley as well.
Mm-hmm. So you've been a lifelong resident of Hamilton.
Yes,
you've been following this for years.
Yes.
And you're not one of those extremist activist types. You're just a Hamiltonian who decided to take a chance and stand up for something she believed in very strongly.
Yes, that's right. I have been a member of the Friends of the Red Hill Valley for a number of years. Of course, I read the Hamilton Spectator and the Stony Creek News, and I have been impressed with those medical people, spokespersons from McMaster, Dr. Pengally, and also Dr. Alvin Lee, who have warned about the health risks that would result from building this road through the valley.
So do you object to an expressway being built, or do you object to the fact that it's going in the woods, in the valley?
Well, I realize that we need to have roads for transportation, not just for people getting back and forth to work and to the supermarket and so on. We also need to have this kind of infrastructure for business. But certainly to put an expressway through the valley not only damages the environment, I think that it removes a recreation space that is very critical, not just to the health, air quality, but for the recreational opportunities for families and individuals. People walk their dogs, young people cycle, people hike through there, and these retreats from concrete and cars are just becoming less available to us as time passes.
Okay, I want to get around the table here, and I want to get to your, we're just going to lightly touch on your partner in crime here. We have, to your right is Mary. She basically is the person responsible for locking you up to that tree. You want to say what your thoughts were, Mary, why you did that? Or?
Well, first of all, my name is Mary Bohachuk.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Well, what were you thinking when you took your friend into the woods and chained her up to a tree?
Well, I'll tell you, there was a lot of preparation mentally before I did that. And because I had originally decided that I was going to chain myself to a tree because I feel that deeply about this valley. But as I was involved in an accident, I had a back injury, I got kind of frightened. I thought, well, you know what? I have to really rethink this. Anyway, I did. We got to the valley, and I helped Barbara chain herself to the tree. And I knew part of me was kind of apprehensive, and part of me was kind of sorry that I wasn't going to do it. But so we did. We set Barbara up. And then I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to get home and call all the press.
So then you ran away, left her chained to the tree.
Well, not exactly. No, I saw a couple of friends there up on the top of the hill, a woman that I've known for a long time, and her husband was chained there. So I stood there and kind of supported Barbara and kind of ran around and took a look at what was going on there. But I know Barbara was being very well taken care of. She was being fed. And in short order, there was a policeman come down to talk to her, and Barbara made a marvelous statement, and I was so pleased that she was the one chained up to the tree to say that. but anyway, he came down to make a statement to her, and of course Barbara said she was going to make a statement, and he said, well, I didn't come here to hear yours. She said, well, I heard yours, now I'd like you to hear mine. Other than that, it was a very exciting day. Things were happening, one thing after another, and we kept track of Barbara to make sure that she was taken care of. And other than that, I went home and did what I needed to do and called all the press, and they were there in short order, and we continued from there on.
Okay, and let's move around to Glenn Atwell, who's got an awful lot of history in this city.
Hamilton East has had an affection for the Kings Forest area, you know, like not just in my childhood, it goes back years. A lot of people that grew up in the East End have spent many Father's Day and many Easter walking those areas through those trees, and it's beautiful. It was one of the places I first remember my father taking me along the side of the mountain there and finding little places, these little pockets of natural gas.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And a lot of other families, they tell me the same thing. You could take a small paper cup and put it at a certain place and put a little hole in it, and with a little flick of the lighter, all of a sudden a blue flame comes out of the rocks. And people tell me that they actually still know where the places are in the creek, where the bubbles come up from the bottom of the creek, and that's natural gas seeping up. And if you put a coffee can over that, you can get a fire going in the water.
Are we starting to give kids bad ideas, do you think?
Well, yes. I think kids have known about this for a very long time, and they've been going there for a very long time. And now those kids have grown up, and we're trying to protect that place, keep those magic and spiritual places alive. It goes back a very long time. Do you mind if I just read a little bit out of a very old history book by?
I think this is quite interesting to note that this land is actually owned by the First Nations, and even though it has been supposedly deeded and titled away, there are history books out there, and you're quoting from some of them that tie in the actual original family names and how the land was divided up. So go ahead. Yeah,
this the book was by Mabel Burkholder in 1938, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how the natives felt about this area. This came from a man's diary, a Captain Patrick Campbell of the 42nd, and he wrote this in around 1791 to 1792, and he just talks about how the natives felt about this area here. And he said that... that in that night, Mr. Beasley had entertained us with hospitality, and I was told of a phenomenon that surprises everybody in this neighborhood, supposed to be a volcano, which makes at certain times a loud report, resembling that of a great gun in the distance. The Indians only know the spot which it is, and from a foolish notion or tradition amongst them, will not discover it. They suppose it is occasioned by the Great Spirit, and how soon the white people find it out that they are to be extirpated the land, and if not from the face of the earth, and an end put to their race. This opinion prevails amongst them. No inducement will make them discover it. Now, I mention that because what they're talking about here is natural gas, and the natural gas would gather in pockets and upon occasion explode and make a very loud noise. So we're talking about natives who believe to their very bones that this area cannot be destroyed. And it's very important that we protect these areas. They're very rare and worthy of protection.
Did you want to say something, Mary, about the history?
Well, I don't know about the history. My own personal view is I live on Mud Street. That's been closed off. Mm-hmm. And Stony Creek Council was responsible for that a few years ago. And their reputation is not very good, as is neither is Hamilton City Council's. So what has happened is we've had nothing but problems since we've been closed off. And now, as I sit here and speak, the road, Mud Street, is a mess with mud. Mm-hmm. And what the construction companies are doing and what they will continue to do to a valley that is my place of meditation. And I have been on Mud Street for 39 years, and the devastation is yet to come.
Well, okay, I think it's important for people to know that why the area was important to natives. It was a burial ground. They did live there, and for a very long time hunted and fished and lived in that valley. And the archaeological evidence of that is still laying there in the valley, being dragged up by bulldozers, mm-hmm. and things like to that effect. People can go down right now because it's still open. You can see it for yourself. And the baseball diamonds down below the Rosedale Arena area, where an archaeological site of the longhouses still exists, and you can see that without being detained, whereas the 11,000-year-old site, which is along the edge of the top of the mountain, if you try to access that and go and see those archaeological evidence of occupation there, you will be charged.
And that's the one that they're going to try and blow up coming in January, right?
Well, that's right. That's right on the edge of the mountain.
So they're going to blast history right out of the earth this
morning? Oh, yes. They actually have the red lines on the art marking out the places they're going to start drilling very soon, and it's very disturbing. That area has been a burial grounds for eons, and that is generally because of the waterfalls at Albion Falls. When the water comes over the edge here, it creates a large rainbow, and I don't know if people really realize that rainbow was a spiritual road. It was between people who were alive, the people who had passed on to the sky world, and the circle of life is that rainbow. And many people believe when they see that they're looking at the medicine wheel. So for native people who had lived there since the time of the Ice Age, they would bring their loved ones there and leave them there, because that is the place where, when the sun set in the west, when they were at those sites where we know where they are, the light would come through the mist of the waterfalls, and they would see that rainbow, and that rainbow would comfort them. And I see that place disappearing quickly now, and we don't have too much time to act. We have to pressure the government very quickly into saving that, because we're at this period of time, only a matter of weeks before so much destruction occurs that it'll never be recovered. And although the social aspect, we're looking at the physical destruction of a valley, and we're looking at the social aspect, the destruction of a people.
Mm-hmm. And that's just the alienation, the invisibleness of the First Nations. And you sent me a few pictures of these amazing trees that have been actually trained to grow into a form and a shape to be a burial site. So we're not looking for burials in the ground all the time.
No, but they do exist. There's one there called the Lottridge find. When the CN Tracks went across the valley, they disturbed a burial, and they had found a silver chalice. This chalice is probably from the time of the French regime when they were Catholic. And so at that time, they were actually interring people in the ground. So remains are there. They have found them. They're trying to hide that fact by saying that they're not finding much. But they did find things that, in other times in the King's Forest Golf Course. And so people have for generations been picking up arrowheads and pieces of flint and things that they generally found laying on the ground. Mm-hmm. And my own father would tell me about going there and looking for arrowheads. It was a very common activity on weekends for children to do. And the reason these things are on the surface of the ground and not buried in the ground is that they would have been placed in platforms, placed in the trees. Mm-hmm. And as time progressed, the items that were in these trees would fall to the earth, and people would, for generations, be picking them up. The finds are now rare and far between, but they do exist all along that area. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to realize that this place is precious to the First Nations, because they gather medicines there, and they've hunted and fished there. They were pushed off the land. They didn't sell it. They did have a treaty. The Mississaugas did give a treaty, but they reserved that place for themselves for hunting and fishing, and they lived there for well into the 1800s until Governor Bondhead in the Indian Act had actually forced them to leave. So for the First Nations, it's very special, but for every nation in this, every person from every nation in Hamilton, this is an important place. Not just for environmentalists, not for just for people that are old and young. This is for every single person.
It's a spiritual place.
And it's a very special place.
Okay, so we have a little bit more information we can play you. There was another story you were telling us, too, about the ghosts and the owls and the sightings.
Oh.
That's still current, isn't it?
I keep. I'm receiving a lot of emails from people citing owl in the right at the bottom of Albion Road there. That was the home of the Cook family, and the home of the father of William Winer Cook, who died at the Battle of Little Bighorn. It's for natives, the Battle of Little Bighorn is part of their history, but not a part that they like to preserve. But I think for Hamiltonians, they need to understand that it's a big part of that history as well. The house itself was 5 stories high, and it burned to the ground. I've actually had 3 fires prior to that where the barns were lost to Mr. Cook. And it might have a lot to do with that natural gas phenomena that we mentioned, where perhaps the fires kept open flames at the time when they were using kerosene lights and stuff. It was probably causing a lot of the fires. But it's a very important part of Hamilton's history there, and it's been totally lost and forgotten. Heritage Canada is looking into it, but it's almost too late already.
And Heritage Canada is being run by the finance minister, so.
Oh, well,
so
there we go.
We know how far we're going to get with that, right?
Well,
that was from 2003. From there, we moved to some music from the natives that were actually in the longhouse that they built in the valley. What we're hearing was actually recorded in the longhouse that was raided just last week and torn down within hours. After 8 years, what are the results of losing that urban wildlife, those trees that we told would be replaced by 5 trees for 1? Physically impossible to do. Since then, we've gone up in our parts per million pollution by hundreds. The very first fall that those trees were gone, our pollution index rocketed up way over 100. The temperatures became hotter. We've had several floods already in the Stony Creek area, right at the base of the Red Hill Valley. The award-winning Red Hill Expressway actually flooded with our new rain. It was closed, impossible to drive, because climate has changed. In 2007 and 2008, we started to see the results of temperature change. Our rainstorms are sudden, unpredictable, and intense.
They're miniature floods. You don't know where they're going to land. You don't know how long they're going to be. You don't know where it is to be safe. Followed by intense lightning and thunder, like I've never heard in my life before. Many power outages, lots of water running through the streets 2 feet deep, picking up pollutants and putting it into our Lake Ontario, which is where we get our drinking water. Is our water safe to drink now? I wonder. The city of Hamilton, Ontario, is an excellent example of what not to do. After fighting and fighting for years, Larry Deanney was finally elected mayor of the city. He and his developer friends started to work right away. They had deep pockets. Their friends and contacts were politicians. It was very transparent to see what was going on politically, locally, regionally, provincially, and yes, as high as the federal government. Paul Wilson was there then. Paul Wilson owns a shipping industry. This 7-kilometer road to link the Queenie to the newly paved link that runs across the mountain brow here in Hamilton tore out over 40,000 trees.
Coming up next, we're going to be playing one of the cuts from the new Keepers of the Sacred Fire CD. This is a great CD put together for a good cause to make people more aware of what's going on in our very own community. All of the musicians on the album have donated their songs and their talent for free. This is David Hind on guitar and vocal with Ralph Michelli. It was recorded using my old Wurlitzer piano tied to the ground.
Got a freaked out friend. She says ship's going down. And there's a great big black cloud, a hanging death over Hamilton. Well, it's beautiful in the sort of motorway. Times like this, I'm sure that we all gonna pay. But we will pay, as if anyone knows how we might save today. And when the sun don't come up for the next 3 days, smoke will now rise and our homes get in the way, so we try not to breathe, but it doesn't work. In times like this, I'm sure that we all gonna be cursed, but we'll be cursed if we don't stop putting the earth first. Cause we all tied to the ground, we're tied to the ground. Got a great big gold tree shining up out of my backyard. And when I swing in those leaves, my life don't feel so hard. Got a bird on a branch sitting right next to me, with a song that they have sung for centuries. Through history, will you now please teach that song to me? Cause we all tied to the ground, we're tied to the ground. Yeah, we all tied to the ground we were tied to the ground. Yeah, we all tied to the ground we were tied to the ground. We all tied to the ground, we were tied to the ground.
This has been The Other Side of the News. I'm your host, Maggie Hughes, and I thank you for listening. We're on every Tuesday afternoon from noon to 1 p.m., 93.3 FM, and you can get us on your computer at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca, www.oside.ca. That's the webpage for this show.
Redefining Radio.
CFMU.